Just So Stories. How the Whale Got His Throat. In the sea, once upon a time, oh my best beloved, there was a whale, and he ate fishes. He ate the starfish and the garfish, and the crab and the dab, and the plaice and the dace, and the skate and his mate, and the mackerel and the pickerel, and the really truly twirly whirly eel. All the fishes he could find in all the sea he ate with his mouth so. Till at last there was only one small fish left in all the sea, and he was a small stooty fish, and he swam a little behind the whale's right ear, so as to be out of harm's way. Then the whale stood up on his tail and said, "I'm hungry." And the small stooty fish said in a small stooty voice, "Noble and generous cetacean, have you ever tasted man?"
"No," said the whale.
"What is it like?"
"Nice," said the small stooty fish.
"Nice but nobly."
"Then fetch me some," said the whale, and he made the sea froth up with his tail.
"One at a time is enough," said the stooty fish. "If you swim to latitude 50 north, longitude 40 west, that is magic, you will find, sitting on a raft, in the middle of the sea, with nothing on but a pair of blue canvas breeches, a pair of suspenders, you must not forget the suspenders, best beloved, and a jackknife, one shipwrecked mariner, who, it is only fair to tell you, is a man of infinite resource and sagacity." So the whale swam and swam to latitude 50 north, longitude 40 west, as fast as he could swim, and on a raft, in the middle of the sea, with nothing to wear except a pair of blue canvas breeches, a pair of suspenders, you must particularly remember the suspenders, best beloved, and a jackknife, he found one single, solitary shipwrecked mariner, trailing his toes in the water. He had his mummy's leave to paddle, or else he would never have done it, because he was a man of infinite resource and sagacity. Then the whale opened his mouth back and back and back till it nearly touched his tail, and he swallowed the shipwrecked mariner, and the raft he was sitting on, and his blue canvas breeches, and the suspenders, which you must not forget, and the jackknife. He swallowed them all down into his warm, dark, inside cupboards, and then he smacked his lips so, and turned round three times on his tail. But as soon as the mariner, who was a man of infinite resource and sagacity, found himself truly inside the whale's warm, dark, inside cupboards, he stumped and he jumped and he thumped and he bumped, and he pranced and he danced, and he banged and he clanged, and he hit and he bit, and he leapt and he creeped, and he prowled and he howled, and he hopped and he dropped, and he cried and he sighed, and he crawled and he bawled, and he stepped and he leapt, and he danced hornpipes where he shouldn't, and the whale felt most unhappy indeed. "Have you forgotten the suspenders?" So he said to the stooty fish, "This man is very nubbly, and besides he is making me hiccup. What shall I do?"
"Tell him to come out," said the stooty fish.
So the whale called down his own throat to the shipwrecked mariner, "Come out and behave yourself. I've got the hiccups."
"Nay, nay," said the mariner. "Not so, but far otherwise. Take me to my natal shore in the white cliffs of Albion, and I'll think about it." And he began to dance more than ever.
"You had better take him home," said the stooty fish to the whale. "I ought to have warned you that he is a man of infinite resource and sagacity." So the whale swam and swam and swam, with both flippers and his tail, as hard as he could for the hiccups, and at last he saw the mariner's natal shore and the white cliffs of Albion, and he rushed halfway up the beach, and opened his mouth wide and wide and wide, and said, "Change here for Winchester, Ashuelot, Nashua, Keene, and stations on the Fitchburg Road," and just as he said Fitch the mariner walked out of his mouth. But while the whale had been swimming, the mariner, who was indeed a person of infinite resource and sagacity, had taken his jackknife and cut up the raft into a little square grating all running crisscross, and he had tied it firm with his suspenders. "Now, you know why you were not to forget the suspenders," and he dragged that grating good and tied into the whale's throat, and there it stuck. Then he recited the following sloka, which, as you have not heard it, I will now proceed to relate. "By means of a grating I have stopped your otting." For the mariner he was also an Hibernian. And he stepped out on the shingle, and went home to his mother, who had given him leave to trail his toes in the water, and he married and lived happily ever afterward. So did the whale. But from that day on, the grating in his throat, which he could neither cough up nor swallow down, prevented him eating anything except very, very small fish, and that is the reason why whales nowadays never eat men or boys or little girls. The small stooty fish went and hid himself in the mud under the door sills of the Equator. He was afraid that the whale might be angry with him. The sailor took the jackknife home. He was wearing the blue canvas breeches when he walked out on the shingle. The suspenders were left behind, you see, to tie the grating with, and that is the end of that tale.
When the cabin portholes are dark and green because of the seas outside, when the ship goes wop, with a wiggle between, and the steward falls into the soup tureen, and the trunks begin to slide, when Nursey lies on the floor in a heap, and Mummy tells you to let her sleep, and you aren't waked or washed or dressed, why, then you will know, if you haven't guessed, you're 50 north and 40 west. How the camel got his hump. Now this is the next tale, and it tells how the camel got his big hump. In the beginning of years, when the world was so new and all, and the animals were just beginning to work for man, there was a camel, and he lived in the middle of a howling desert because he did not want to work, and besides, he was a howler himself. So he ate sticks and thorns and tamarisks and milkweed and prickles, most excruciating idle, and when anybody spoke to him he said Humphrey. Just Humphrey. And no more. Presently the horse came to him on Monday morning, with a saddle on his back and a bit in his mouth, and said, Camel, O camel, come out and trot like the rest of us. Humphrey, said the camel, and the horse went away and told the man. Presently the dog came to him, with a stick in his mouth, and said, Camel, O camel, come and fetch and carry like the rest of us. Humphrey, said the camel, and the dog went away and told the man. Presently the ox came to him, with a yoke on his neck and said, Camel, O camel, come and plow like the rest of us. Humphrey, said the camel, and the ox went away and told the man. At the end of the day the man called the horse and the dog and the ox together, and said, Three, O three, I'm very sorry for you, with the world so new and all, but that Humphrey thing in the desert can't work, or he would have been here by now, so I am going to leave him alone, and you must work double time to make up for it. That made the three very angry, with the world so new and all, and they held a palaver, and an indaba, and a punch-a-a, and a powwow on the edge of the desert, and the camel came chewing on milkweed most excruciating idle, and laughed at them. Then he said Humphrey, and went away again. Presently there came along the djinn in charge of all deserts, rolling in a cloud of dust. Djinns always travel that way because it is magic, and he stopped to palaver and pow-pow with the three. Djinn of all deserts, said the horse, is it right for anyone to be idle, with the world so new and all? Certainly not, said the djinn. Well, said the horse, there's a thing in the middle of your howling desert, and he's a howler himself, with a long neck and long legs, and he hasn't done a stroke of work since Monday morning. He won't trot. Phew, said the djinn, whistling, that's my camel, for all the gold in Arabia. What does he say about it? He says Humphrey, said the dog, and he won't fetch and carry. Does he say anything else? Only Humphrey, and he won't plow, said the ox. Very good, said the djinn. I'll hump them if you will kindly wait a minute. The djinn rolled himself up in his dust cloak, and took a bearing across the desert, and found the camel most excruciatingly idle, looking at his own reflection in a pool of water. My long and bubbling friend, said the djinn, what's this I hear of your doing no work, with the world so new and all? Humphrey, said the camel. The djinn sat down, with his chin in his hand, and began to think a great magic, while the camel looked at his own reflection in the pool of water. You've given the three extra work ever since Monday morning, all on account of your excruciating idleness, said the djinn, and he went on thinking magics, with his chin in his hand. Humphrey, said the camel. I shouldn't say that again if I were you, said the djinn, you might say it once too often. Bubbles, I want you to work. And the camel said Humphrey. Again, but no sooner had he said it than he saw his back, that he was so proud of, puffing up and puffing up into a great big lolloping hump. Do you see that? Said the djinn. That's your very own hump that you've brought upon your very own self by not working. Today is Thursday, and you've done no work since Monday, when the work began. Now you are going to work. How can I, said the camel, with this hump on my back? That's May Day purpose, said the djinn, all because you missed those 3 days. You will be able to work now for 3 days without eating, because you can live on your hump, and don't you ever say I never did anything for you. Come out of the desert and go to the three, and behave. Humphrey yourself. And the camel humped himself, hump and all, and went away to join the three. And from that day to this the camel always wears a hump, we call it hump now, not to hurt his feelings, but he has never yet caught up with the 3 days that he missed at the beginning of the world, and he has never yet learned how to behave. The camel's hump is an ugly lump which well you may see at the zoo, but uglier yet is the hump we get from having too little to do. Kiddies and grown-ups too, ooh, if we haven't enough to do, we get the hump camellia's hump, the hump that is black and blue. We climb out of bed with a frizzly head and a snarly yarly voice. We shiver and scowl and we grunt and we growl at our bath and our boots and our toys. And there ought to be a corner for me, and I know there is one for you, when we get the hump Camellia's hump, the hump that is black and blue. The cure for this ill is not to sit still, or frost with a book by the fire, but to take a large hoe and a shovel also, and dig till you gently perspire. And then you will find that the sun and the wind, and the gin of the garden too, have lifted the hump, the horrible hump, the hump that is black and blue. I get it as well as you, ooh-ooh, if I haven't enough to do, ooh-ooh, we all get hump, Camellia's hump, kiddies and grown-ups too. How the rhinoceros got his skin. Once upon a time, on an uninhabited island on the shores of the Red Sea, there lived a Parsi from whose hat the rays of the sun were reflected in more than oriental splendor. And the Parsi lived by the Red Sea with nothing but his hat and his knife and a cooking stove of the kind that you must particularly never touch. And one day he took flour and water and currants and plums and sugar and things, and made himself one cake which was 2 feet across and 3 feet thick. It was indeed a superior comestible, that's magic, and he put it on stove because he was allowed to cook on the stove, and he baked it and he baked it till it was all done brown and smelt most sentimental. But just as he was going to eat it, there came down to the beach from the altogether uninhabited interior one rhinoceros with a horn on his nose, two piggy eyes, and few manners. In those days the rhinoceros's skin fitted him quite tight. There were no wrinkles in it anywhere. He looked exactly like a Noah's Ark rhinoceros, but of course much bigger. All the same, he had no manners then, and he has no manners now, and he never will have any manners. He said, "How?" And the Parsi left that cake and climbed to the top of a palm tree with nothing on but his hat, from which the rays of the sun were always reflected in more than oriental splendor. And the rhinoceros upset the oil stove with his nose, and the cake rolled on the sand, and he spiked the cake on the horn of his nose, and he ate it, and he went away, waving his tail, to the desolate and exclusively uninhabited interior which abuts on the islands of Mazanderan, Socotra, and promontories of the larger equinox. Then the Parsi came down from his palm tree and put the stove on its legs and recited the following sloka, which, as you have not heard, I will now proceed to relate, dash. Them that takes cakes which the Parsi man bakes makes dreadful mistakes. And there was a great deal more in that than you would think. Because, 5 weeks later, there was a heat wave in the Red Sea, and everybody took off all the clothes they had. The Parsi took off his hat, but the rhinoceros took off his skin and carried it over his shoulder as he came down to the beach to bathe. In those days it buttoned underneath with 3 buttons and looked like a waterproof. He said nothing whatever about the Parsi's cake, because he had eaten it all, and he never had any manners, then, since, or henceforward. He waddled straight into the water and blew bubbles through his nose, leaving his skin on the beach. Presently the Parsi came by and found the skin, and he smiled one smile that ran all round his face 2 times. Then he danced 3 times round the skin and rubbed his hands. Then he went to his camp and filled his hat with cake crumbs, for the Parsi never ate anything but cake, and never swept out his camp. He took that skin, and he shook that skin, and he scrubbed that skin, and he rubbed that skin just as full of old, dry, stale, tickly cake crumbs and some burned currants as ever it could possibly hold. Then he climbed to the top of his palm tree and waited for the rhinoceros to come out of the water and put it on. And the rhinoceros did. He buttoned it up with the 3 buttons, and it tickled like cake crumbs in bed. Then he wanted to scratch, but that made it worse, and then he lay down on the sands and rolled and rolled and rolled, and every time he rolled the cake crumbs tickled him worse and worse and worse. Then he ran to the palm tree and rubbed and rubbed and rubbed himself against it. He rubbed so much and so hard that he rubbed his skin into a great fold over his shoulders, and another fold underneath, where the buttons used to be, but he rubbed the buttons off, and he rubbed some more folds over his legs. And it spoiled his temper, but it didn't make the least difference to the cake crumbs. They were inside his skin and they tickled. So he went home, very angry indeed and horribly scratchy, and from that day to this every rhinoceros has great folds in his skin and a very bad temper, all on account of the cake crumbs inside. But the Parsi came down from his palm tree, wearing his hat, from which the rays of the sun were reflected in more than oriental splendor, packed up his cooking stove, and went away in the direction of Uratavo, Amygdala, the upland meadows of Anantarivo, and the marshes of Sonaput. This uninhabited island is off Cape Gardafu, by the beaches of Socotra and the Pink Arabian Sea, but it's hot, too hot from Suez for the likes of you and me ever to go in a P&O. And call on the cake Parsi how the leopard got his spots. In the days when everybody started fair, best beloved, the leopard lived in a place called the High Veld. Remember, it wasn't the Low Veld, or the bush veld, or the sour veld, but the exclusively bare, hot, shiny high veld, where there was sand and sandy-colored rock and exclusively tufts of sandy yellowish grass. The giraffe and the zebra and the eel and the kudu and the hartebeest lived there, and they were exclusively sandy yellow brownish all over, but the leopard, he was the exclusivest sandiest yellowish brownest of them all, a grayish yellowish caddy-shaped kind of beast, and he matched the exclusively yellowish grayish brownish color of the high veld to one hair. This was very bad for the giraffe and the zebra and the rest of them, for he would lie down by exclusively yellowish grayish brownish stone or clump of grass, and when the giraffe or the zebra or the eland or the kudu or the bush buck or the bonte buck came by, he would surprise them out of their jumpsome lives. He would indeed. And, also, there was an Ethiopian with bows and arrows, exclusively grayish brownish yellowish man he was then, who lived on the high veld with the leopard, and the two used to hunt together, the Ethiopian with his bows and arrows, and the leopard exclusively with his teeth and claws, till the giraffe and the eland and the kudu and the quagga and all the rest of them didn't know which way to jump, best beloved. They didn't indeed. After a long time things lived forever so long in those days, they learned to avoid anything that looked like a leopard or an Ethiopian, and bit by bit the giraffe began it, because his legs were the longest they went away from the high veld. They scuttled for days and days and days till they came to a great forest, exclusively full of trees and bushes and stripy, speckly, patchy blatchy shadows, and there they hid, and after another long time, what with standing half in the shade and half out of it, and what with the slippery slidey shadows of the trees falling on them, the giraffe grew blotchy, and the zebra grew stripy, and the eland and the kudu grew darker, with little wavy gray lines on their backs like bark on a tree trunk, and so, though you could hear them and smell them, you could very seldom see them, and then only when you knew precisely where to look. They had a beautiful time in the exclusively speckly spickly shadows of the forest, while the leopard and the Ethiopian ran about over the exclusively grayish yellowish reddish high veld outside, wondering where all their breakfasts and their dinners and their teas had gone. At last they were so hungry that they ate rats and beetles and rock rabbits, the leopard and the Ethiopian, and then they had the big tummy ache, both together, and then they met Bavian the dog-headed, barking baboon, who is quite the wisest animal in all South Africa. Said leopard to Bavian, and it was a very hot day, where has all the game gone? And Bavian winked. He knew. Said the Ethiopian to Bavian, can you tell me the present habitat of the aboriginal fauna? That meant just the same thing, but the Ethiopian always used long words. He was a grown-up. And Bavian winked. He knew. Then said Bavian, the game has gone into other spots, and my advice to you, leopard, is to go into other spots as soon as you can. And the Ethiopian said, that is all very fine, but I wish to know whither the aboriginal fauna has migrated. Then said Bavian, the aboriginal fauna has joined the aboriginal flora because it was high time for a change, and my advice to you, Ethiopian, is to change as soon as you can. That puzzled the leopard and the Ethiopian, but they set off to look for the aboriginal flora, and presently, after ever so many days, they saw a great, high, tall forest full of tree trunks all exclusively speckled and sprottled and spottled, dotted and splashed and slashed and hatched and cross-hatched with shadows. Say that quickly aloud, and you will see how very shadowy the forest must have been. What is this, said the leopard, that is so exclusively dark, and yet so full of little pieces of light? I don't know, said the Ethiopian, but it ought to be the aboriginal flora. I can smell giraffe, and I can hear giraffe, but I can't see giraffe. That's curious, said the leopard. I suppose it is because we have just come in out of the sunshine. I can smell zebra, and I can hear zebra, but I can't see zebra. Wait a bit, said the Ethiopian. It's a long time since we've hunted them. Perhaps we've forgotten what they were like. Fiddle, said the leopard. I remember them perfectly on the high veld, especially their marrow bones. Giraffe is about 17 feet high, of exclusively fulvous golden yellow from head to heel, and zebra is about 4.5 feet high, of exclusively gray fawn color from head to heel. Said the Ethiopian, looking into the speckly spickly shadows of the aboriginal flora forest. Then they ought to show up in this dark place like ripe bananas in a smokehouse. But they didn't. The leopard and the Ethiopian hunted all day, and though they could smell them and hear them, they never saw one of them. For goodness sake, said the leopard at tea time, let us wait till it gets dark. This daylight hunting is a perfect scandal. So they waited till dark, and then the leopard heard something breathing snivelly in the starlight that fell all stripy through the branches, and he jumped at the noise, and it smelt like zebra, and it felt like zebra, and when he knocked it down it kicked like zebra, but he couldn't see it. So he said, "Be quiet, O you person without any form. I am going to sit on your head till morning, because there is something about you that I don't understand." Presently he heard a grunt and a crash and a scramble, and the Ethiopian called out, "I've caught a thing that I can't see. It smells like giraffe, and it kicks like giraffe, but it hasn't any form." "Don't you trust it," said the leopard. "Sit on its head till the morning same as me. They haven't any form, any of them." So they sat down on them hard till bright morning time, and then leopard said, "What have you at your end of the table, brother?" The Ethiopian scratched his head and said, "It ought to be exclusively a rich bovis orange tawny from head to heel, and it ought to be giraffe, but it is covered all over with chestnut blotches. What have you at your end of the table, brother?" And the leopard scratched his head and said, "It ought to be exclusively a delicate grayish fawn, and it ought to be zebra, but it is covered all over with black and purple stripes. What in the world have you been doing to yourself, zebra? Don't you know that if you were on the high veld I could see you 10 miles off? You haven't any form." "Yes," said the zebra, "but this isn't the high veld. Can't you see?"
"I can now," said the leopard. "But I couldn't all yesterday. How is it done?"
"Let us up," said the zebra, "and we will show you." They let the zebra and the giraffe get up, and zebra moved away to some little thorn bushes where the sunlight fell all stripy, and giraffe moved off to some tallish trees where the shadows fell all blotchy.
"Now watch," said the zebra and the giraffe. "This is the way it's done. 1, 2, 3. And where's your breakfast?" Leopard stared, and Ethiopian stared, but all they could see were stripy shadows and blotched shadows in the forest, but never a sign of zebra and giraffe. They had just walked off and hidden themselves in the shadowy forest.
"Hi. Hi," said the Ethiopian. "That's a trick worth a learning. Take a lesson by it, leopard. You show up in this dark place like a bar of soap in a coal scuttle."
"Ho. Ho," said the leopard. "Would it surprise you very much to know that you show up in this dark place like a mustard plaster on a sack of coal?"